shrill electronic noise at higher than full volume, as if attempting to shatter their flesh and bones as a perfectly sung and sustained high C could shatter fine crystal. Ross Mondale sat on a shipping crate and buried his face in his hands as if weeping. Dan Haldane was startled and disconcerted. He had been certain that Mondale was incapable of tears. The captain didn't sob or wheeze or make any other sounds, and when he looked up again after half a minute or so, his eyes were perfectly dry. He hadn't been weeping after all, merely thinking, desperately thinking. He had also been putting on a new expression, a conscious act not unlike exchanging one mask for another. The fear and worry and anger were completely gone. Even the hatred was fairly well hidden, although a dark rime of it was still visible in the captain's eyes, like a film of black ice on a shallow puddle at the edge of winter. Now he was wearing his patented, friendly and humble face, which was transparently insincere. "Okay, Dan. Okay. We were friends once. And maybe we can be friends again." We were never really friends, Dan thought, but he said nothing. He was curious to see how conciliatory Ross Mondale would pretend to be. Mondale said, "At least we can start by trying to work together. And I can help by acknowledging that you're a damned good detective. You're methodical, but you're also intuitive. I shouldn't try to rein you in, because that's like refusing to let a natural-born hunting dog follow its own nose. Okay. So you're on your own in this case. Go wherever you want, see who you want, when you want. Just try to fill me in once in a while. I'd appreciate it. Maybe if we both give a little, both of us bend a little, then we'll find that we not only can work together, but can even be friends again." Dan decided that he liked Mondale's anger and unconcealed hatred better than this smarmy appeasement. The captain's hatred was the most honest thing about him. Now the honey in his voice and manner didn't soothe Dan. In fact, it made his skin crawl. "But can I ask you one thing?" Mondale said, leaning forward from his perch on the packing crate, looking earnest.
"What's that?"
"Why this case? Why are you so passionately committed to it?"
"I just want to do my job."
"It's more than that." Dan gave nothing.
"Is it the woman?"
"No. She's very good-looking."
"It's not the woman," Dan said, though Laura McCaffrey's beauty had not escaped his attention.
It did indeed play at least a small role in his determination to stay with the case, though he would never reveal as much to Mondale.
"Is it the kid?"
"Maybe," Dan said. "You've always worked hardest on cases where a child was abused or threatened."
"Not always."
"Yes, always," Mondale said. "Is that because of what happened to your brother and sister?"
The radio vibrated harder, faster. It rattled against the counter with sufficient force to chip the tiles, and abruptly floated into the air, levitated.
It hung up there, swaying, bobbing at the end of its cord as a helium-filled balloon might bubble at the end of a string. Laura was beyond surprise. She watched, immobilized by awe, no longer even terribly afraid, simply numb with cold and with incredulity. The electronic whine became more shrill, thin, spiraled up like the tape-recorded descent of a bomb played in reverse. Laura looked down at Melanie and saw that the girl had at last begun to rise out of her stupor. She hadn't opened her eyes yet. In fact, she was now squeezing them shut, but she had raised her small hands to her ears, and her mouth was open too. Snakes of smoke erupted from the miraculously suspended radio. It exploded. Laura closed her eyes and ducked her head just as the Sony blew up. Bits of broken plastic rained over her, snapped against her arms, head, hands.
A few large chunks of the radio, still attached to the cord, fell straight to the floor, the invisible hands no longer providing support, and hit the tiles with a clank and clatter. The plug pulled from the wall, and the cord slithered across the counter. It dropped onto the floor with the rest of the shattered Sony, and was still. When the explosion had come, Melanie had finally responded to the chaos around her. She erupted from her chair, and even before the flying debris had finished falling, she scurried on hands and knees into the corner by the back door. Now she cowered there, head sheltered under her arms, sobbing. In the silence following the cessation of the radio's banshee wail, the child's sobs were especially penetrating. Each, like a soft blow, landed on Laura's heart, not with physical force, but with enormous emotional impact, hammering her alternately toward despair and terror. When Dan didn't respond, Mondale repeated the question in a tone of innocent curiosity, but his undertone was taunting and mean. "Do you work harder on those cases involving child abuse because of what happened to your brother and sister?" "Maybe," Dan said, wishing he had never told Mondale about those tragedies. But when two young cops share a squad car, they usually spill their guts to each other during the long night patrols. He had spilled too much before he'd realized that he didn't like Mondale and never would. "Maybe that's part of why I don't want to let go of this case. But it's not the whole story. It's also because of Cindy Lakey. Don't you see that, Ross? Here's another case where a woman and child are in danger, a mother and her daughter threatened by a maniac, maybe more than one maniac, just like the Lakeys. So maybe it's a chance for me to redeem myself. A chance to make up for my failure to save Cindy Lakey, to finally get rid of a little of that guilt." Mondale stared at him, astonished. "You feel guilty? Because the Lakey kid was killed?" Dan nodded. "I should have shot Dunbar the moment he turned toward me with that gun. I shouldn't have hesitated. Shouldn't have given him a chance to drop it. If I'd wasted him right away, he'd never have gotten into that house." Amazed, Mondale said, "But Christ, you know what it was like back then, even worse than now. The grand jury was looking into half a dozen charges of police brutality, whether the accusations had substance or not. Every half-assed political activist had it in for the whole department in those days. Even worse than now, even when a cop shot someone in a clear-cut act of self-defense, they howled for his head. Everyone was supposed to have rights except cops. Cops were supposed to just stand there and take bullets in the chest. The reporters, politicians, the ACLU, they all talked about us like we were bloodthirsty fascists. Shit, man, you remember?"
"I remember," Dan said. "And that's why I didn't shoot Dunbar when I should have. I could see the guy was unbalanced, dangerous. I knew intuitively that he was going to kill somebody that night. But in the back of my mind I was thinking about all the heat we were under, all the accusations about being trigger-happy cops. And I knew if I shot him, I'd have to answer for it. In the climate we had back then, I figured nobody would listen to me. I'd be sacrificed. I was worried about losing my job, being booted off the force. I was afraid of destroying my career, and so I waited until he brought the gun around, waited until he pointed it right straight at me. But I gave him just a second too long, and he got me. And because they didn't go with my instincts or with my intellect, he had a chance to get Cindy Lakey, too." Mondale shook his head adamantly.
"But none of that was your fault. Blame the goddamn social reformers who take sides without any understanding of the goddamn situation we face, without knowing what it's like out there on the streets. They're to blame, not you, not me."
Dan glared at him. "Don't you dare put yourself in the same boat with me. Don't you dare. You ran, Ross. I screwed up because I was thinking about my own ass, about my pension, for God's sake, when I should have been thinking about nothing other than doing the job the best way I could. That's why I have guilt to live with, but don't you ever imply the burden lies equally on you and me. It doesn't. That's crap, and you know it." Mondo was trying to look earnest and concerned. But he was having increasing difficulty suppressing his hatred.
"Or maybe you don't know it," Dan said. "That's even scarier. Maybe you aren't just covering your own backside. Maybe you really think that looking out for number one is the only moral position that makes sense."
Without replying, Mondale got up and went to the door. Dan said, "Is your conscience actually clear, Ross?"
"God help you. I think maybe it is."
Mondale glanced back at him. "You do what you want to do in this case, but stay out of my way.
You haven't lost a single night's sleep over Cindy Lakey, have you, Ross?"
"I said stay out of my way."
"Happily.
I don't want to have to listen to any more of your coughing and whining."
"You're incredible."
Without replying, Mondale opened the door.
"What planet are you from, Ross?"
Mondale walked out.
"I'll bet there's only one color on his home planet,"
Dan said to the empty room.
"Brown. Everything must be brown on his world. That's why his clothes are all brown. They remind him of home."
It was a weak joke. Maybe that was why he couldn't make himself smile.
Maybe.
The kitchen was still. The silence held. The air was warm once more.
"It's over," Earl said.
Paralysis relaxed its grip on Laura. A circuit board from the demolished radio crunched under her foot as she stepped across the kitchen and knelt beside Melanie. With soothing words, with much patting and stroking, she calmed her daughter. She wiped the tears from the child's face. Earl began picking through the debris, studying the pieces of the Sony, mumbling to himself, baffled and fascinated. Sitting on the floor with Melanie, pulling the girl onto her lap, holding her, rocking her, immensely relieved that the child was still there to be comforted, Laura would like to have wished away the events of the past few minutes. She would have given anything to be able to deny the reality of what she had seen. But she was too good a psychiatrist to allow herself to indulge in any of the little mind games that would minimize this bizarre development. Nor would she permit herself to rationalize it away with the standard jargon of her profession. She hadn't been hallucinating. This paranormal episode, this supernatural phenomenon, couldn't be explained away as just sensory confusion, either. Her perceptions had been accurate and reliable in spite of the impossibility of what she had perceived. She had not been overlaying a logical series of events with an illogical and subjective fantasy in the manner of many schizophrenics. Earl had seen it, too. And this wasn't a shared hallucination, a mass delusion. It was crazy, impossible, but real. The radio had been possessed. Some of the pieces of the Sony were still smoking. The air was thick with an acrid, charred plastic odor. Melanie moaned softly, twitched.
"Easy, honey. Easy."
The girl looked up at her mother, and Laura was jolted by the eye contact. Melanie was no longer gazing through her. She had come back from her dark world again, and Laura prayed that this time the girl was back for good, although that was unlikely.
"I want," Melanie said. "What is it, honey? What do you want?"
The girl's eyes searched Laura's.
"I need anything, Melanie. Anything you want, just tell me. Tell Mommy what you need. It'll get them all,"
Melanie said, her voice heavy with dread. Earl had looked up from the smoldering scraps of the radio and was watching intently.
"What?"
Laura asked. "What will get them, honey?"
"And then it'll get me,"
the girl said.
"No," Laura said quickly. "Nothing's going to get you. I'll take care of you. It'll come up from inside."
"Inside where?"
"From inside." "What is it, honey? What are you afraid of? What is it?" "It'll come and eat me,"
No. Eat me. All up, the girl said, and she shuddered. No, Melanie, don't worry about... She let her voice trail away because she saw that the girl's eyes had shifted subtly. They were not entirely out of focus, but neither were they fixed on Laura any more. The child sighed, and her breathing changed. She had gone back into that private place where she had been hiding ever since they'd found her wandering naked in the street. Earl said, "Doc, can you make anything of this?"
"No."
"Because I can't figure it at all."
"Me neither."
Earlier, cooking dinner, she had begun to feel better about Melanie in the future. She'd begun to feel almost normal. But their situation had changed for the worse, and now her nerves were frayed again. In this city, there were people who wanted to kidnap Melanie in order to continue experimenting with her. Laura didn't know what they hoped to achieve or why they had picked on Melanie, but she was certain they were out there. Even the FBI seemed sure of that. Other people wanted the girl dead. The discovery of Ned Rink's body seemed to prove that Melanie's life was indisputably in danger, but now it appeared that those faceless people were not the only ones who wanted to get their hands on Melanie. Now there was another enemy as well. That was the essence of the warning that had come to them through the radio. But who or what had been controlling the radio? And how? Who or what had sent the warning? And why? More important, who was this new enemy? It, the radio had said. And the implication had been that this enemy was more frightening and more dangerous than all the others combined. It was loose, the radio had said. It was coming. They had to run, the radio said. They had to hide from it.
"Mommy? Mom?"
"Right here, honey."
"Mommy?"
"Right here. It's okay. I'm right here.
I'm scared."
Melanie was not speaking to Laura or Earl. She seemed not to have heard Laura's reassurance. She was talking only to herself, in a tone of voice that was the essence of loneliness, the voice of the lost and abandoned.
"So scared. Scared."
Part 3. The Hunted. Wednesday, 8 p.m. to Thursday, 6 a.m. Chapter 22. Still sitting at Joseph Scaldone's desk in the office storeroom behind the shop on Ventura Boulevard, Dan Haldane looked through the diskette storage wheel that stood beside the IBM computer. He read the labels on the floppy disks, and saw that most held nothing of interest for him. However, one of them was marked Customer Mailing List, and that one seemed worth examining. He switched on the computer, studied the menu of options, loaded the proper software, and brought up the mailing list. It appeared in white letters on a blue screen, divided into 26 documents, one for each letter of the alphabet. He summoned the M document and scrolled slowly through it, searching for Dylan McCaffrey. He found the name and address of the house in Studio City. He called up the H document and located Willie Hoffritz. In the C file, he found Ernest Andrew Cooper, the millionaire businessman whose mangled body had been in that Studio City house last night, with McCaffrey and Hoffritz. Dan called up the R file. Ned Rink was there. He had discovered a cord that tied all four victims together, an interest in the occult and, more specifically, patronage of the late Joseph Scaldone's bizarre little shop. He checked under U. There was an address in Ojai and a telephone number for Albert Uhlander, the author of those quirky volumes about the occult, which someone had attempted to remove from Ned Rink's house, and which now were safely stored in the trunk of the department sedan that Dan was using. Who else? He pondered that question, then called up the S-file and searched for Regine Savannah. She was the young woman who had been under Hoffritz's total control and whose beating had resulted in the psychologist's removal from the UCLA faculty 4 years ago. She wasn't one of Scaldone's customers. The G-file, just in case,
but he could find no listing for Ermatrude Gelkenschettel. He hadn't actually expected to find her there. He was slightly ashamed of himself for even checking on it, but it was the nature of a homicide detective to trust no one. Calling up the O-file, he searched for Mary Catherine O'Hara of Burbank, the secretary of Freedom Now, the organization which Cooper and Hoffert served as president and treasurer, respectively. Apparently, Mary O'Hara didn't share her fellow officers' enthusiasm for occult literature and paraphernalia. Dan couldn't think of any more names to look for, but there would most likely be others of interest when he read through the entire mailing list. He ordered a printout. The laser printer produced the first page in seconds. Dan snatched the sheet of paper from the tray and read it while the machine continued to print. There were 20 names and addresses, 2 columns of 10 each. He didn't recognize anybody in that first section of the list. He picked up the second page, and toward the bottom of the second column, he saw a name that was not merely familiar, but startling. Palmer Booth. Owner of the Los Angeles Journal, heir to a huge fortune, but also one of the shrewdest businessmen in the country. Palmer Booth has vastly increased the wealth that he had inherited. He kept his hands in not only the newspaper and magazine business, but also in real estate, banking, motion picture production, transportation, a variety of high-technology industries, broadcasting, agriculture, thoroughbred horse breeding, and probably anything else that made money. He was widely and well-regarded a political power broker, a philanthropist who annually earned the gratitude of a score of charities. A man known for his hard-headed pragmatism. Yeah? How did hard-headed pragmatism coexist with a belief in the occult? Why would a canny businessman, with an appreciation for the no-nonsense rules and methods and laws of capitalism, patronize a strange place like the sign of the pentagram? Curious. Of course, there was virtually no chance whatsoever that Palmer Booth was involved with men like McCaffrey, Hoffritz, and Rink. The appearance of his name on Scaldone's mailing list did not link him to the McCaffrey case. Not everyone who bought from the sign of the pentagram was involved in that conspiracy. Nevertheless, Dan opened Scaldone's personal address book, the item that had precipitated the confrontation with Mondale, and paged to the B listings to see if Palmer Booth was more than merely one of Scaldone's customers. The businessman's name wasn't there, which probably meant that his sole contact with Joseph Scaldone was as an occasional purchaser of occult books and other items. Dan reached to an inside coat pocket and withdrew Dylan McCaffrey's address book. Booth's name wasn't in that one either. Dead end. He had known that it wouldn't be. As an afterthought, he checked McCaffrey's book for Albert Uhlander. The author was there, the same address and phone number in Ojai. He looked in Scaldone's book again. Uhlander was also listed there. The writer was evidently more than just another customer of the sign of the pentagram. He was an integral part of whatever project McCaffrey and Hoffert had been engaged upon. They sure had a jolly little group. Dan wondered what they did when they got together. Compare favorite brands of batshit? Whip up tasty dishes featuring snake eyes? Discuss megalomaniacal schemes to brainwash everyone and rule the world? Torture little girls? The printer spewed out the 15th and final page long before Dan finished scanning the first 14. He collected them, stapled them together, folded the sheets, and put them in his pocket. Nearly 300 names appeared on the mailing list, and he wanted to go over them later when he was alone at home with a beer and could concentrate better. He located an empty stationery box and filled it with Dylan McCaffrey's address book, Scaldone's smaller address book, and several other items. He carried the box out of the office through the store where the coroner's men were bagging Joseph Scaldone's hideously battered corpse, and he went outside. The crowd of curiosity seekers had grown smaller, maybe because the night was colder. A few reporters still lingered in the vicinity of the occult shop, standing with shoulders drawn up, hands in their pockets, shivering. A heat-leaching wind alternately hissed and howled along Ventura Boulevard, sucking the warmth out of the city and everyone in it. The air was heavy, moist. The rains would return before morning. Nolan Swayze, the youngest of the uniformed officers on duty in front of the sign of the pentagram, accepted the box when Dan handed it to him. "Nolan, I want you to take this back to East Valley and give it to clerical. There are two address books among the stuff. I want the contents of both books transcribed, and all the detectives on the special task force should have a copy of the transcriptions in their information packets by tomorrow morning." "Can do," Swayze said. "There's also a diskette. I want the contents printed out with copies to everyone. There's an appointments calendar in there, too."
"Copies to everyone?"
"You'd catch on fast."
Swayze nodded. "I intend to be chief someday."
"Good for you.
Make my mother proud."
"If that's your goal, it's probably wiser to stay a patrolman. There's also a sheaf of invoices here. You want the information transcribed into a less cumbersome format."
"Right," Dan said.
"With copies to everyone."
"Maybe you could even be mayor."
"I've already got my campaign slogan. Let's rebuild L.A.
"Why not? It's worked for every other candidate for 30 years.
"This ledger?"
"It's a checkbook," Dan said.
"You want the information transcribed from the stubs with copies to everyone. Maybe I could even be governor."
"No. You wouldn't like the job."
"Why not?"
"You'd have to live in Sacramento."
"Hey, that's right. I prefer civilization."
Dinner was late because they had to clean up the kitchen. The water for the spaghetti had to be poured out. Bits of the demolished radio were floating in it. Laura scrubbed the pot, refilled it, and put it back on the stove to boil. By the time they sat down to eat, she wasn't hungry anymore. She kept thinking of the radio, which had been infused with a strange and demonic life of its own, and that memory spoiled her appetite. The air was rich with the mouth-watering aromas of garlic and tomato sauce and Parmesan cheese, but there was also an underlying hint of scorched plastic and hot metal that seemed, this was crazy but true, God help her, like the olfactory trace of an evil spiritual presence. Earl Benton ate more than she did, but not much. He didn't talk much, either. He stared at his plate, even when he took a long pause between bites. And the only time he looked up was when he glanced, occasionally, toward that end of the kitchen counter where the Sony had been. His usual, efficient, no-nonsense manner wasn't in evidence now. His eyes had a faraway look. Melanie's eyes were still focused on a far place, too. But the girl ate more than either Laura or Earl Benton. Sometimes she chewed slowly and absent-mindedly, and sometimes she gobbled up 4 or 5 bites in rapid succession with wolf-like hunger. Now and then she altogether forgot that she was eating, and she had to be reminded. Feeding her daughter, repeatedly wiping spaghetti sauce off the child's chin, Laura couldn't avoid thinking about her own blighted childhood. Her mother, Beatrice, had been a religious zealot who had permitted no singing or dancing or reading of books other than the Bible and certain religious tracts. A recluse with a persecution complex, Beatrice had labored hard to ensure that Laura would remain shy, withdrawn, and frightened of the world. If Laura had turned out like Melanie was now, Beatrice no doubt would have been delighted. She would have interpreted schizophrenic catatonia as a rejection of the evil world of the flesh, would have seen it as a deep communion with God. Beatrice would not only have been unable but unwilling to help Laura back into the real world. "But I can help you, honey," Laura thought as she wiped a smear of sauce off her daughter's chin. "I am able and willing to help you find your way back, Melanie. If only you'll reach out to me, if only you'll let me help." Melanie's head dropped, her eyes closed. Laura twisted more spaghetti onto the fork and put it to the girl's lips, but the child seemed to have slipped from apathy into some deeper level, perhaps even sleep. "Come on, Melanie, have another bite. You've got to gain some weight, honey." Something clicked loudly. Earl Benton looked up from his plate. "What was that?" Before Laura could respond, the back door flew open with shocking force. The security chain ripped out of the door jamb, and wood cracked with a hard, splintering sound. The first click had been the deadbolt lock snapping open all by itself. Earl had jumped to his feet, knocking over his chair, from the patio behind the house. Out of the darkness and wind, something came through the door. At 9:15, after talking to the owner of the shop next door to the sign of the pentagram. And learning nothing of interest, Dan stopped at a McDonald's for dinner. He bought 2 cheeseburgers, a large order of fries, and a diet cola, and he ate in the car while he used the unmarked sedan's data link to try to locate Regine Savannah. The video display terminal was in the dashboard, mounted at a slant, facing up, so he didn't have to bend over to read it. The programmer's keyboard nearly filled the console between the seats. All LAPD patrol cars and half the unmarked sedans had been fitted with new computer terminals over the past 2 years. The mobile VDT was linked by microwave transmissions to the underground, high-security, bomb-proof police communications command center, which in turn had access via modem to a variety of government and private industry databanks. Taking a bite of a cheeseburger, Dan started the sedan's engine, switched on the VDT, punched in his personal code, and accessed the telephone company records. He requested a number for Regine Savannah at any address in the greater Los Angeles area. In a few seconds, glowing green letters appeared on the screen. No listing. Savannah, Regine. No listing. Savannah R. He typed in a request for any unlisted numbers being billed to an R or Regine Savannah, but that was a dead end, too. He ate a few French fries. The screen glowed softly, patiently. He accessed the Department of Motor Vehicles license files and requested a search for Regine Savannah. That, too, was negative. As he mulled over another approach, he finished his first cheeseburger and watched the traffic passing on the windswept street. Then he tapped into the DMV files again and requested a search for a driver's license issued to anyone whose first name was Regine and whose middle name was Savannah. Perhaps she'd been married and had not abandoned her maiden name altogether. Pay dirt. The screen flashed up the answer. Regine, Savannah, Hoffritz. Dan stared in disbelief. Hoffritz? Marge Gelkenschettel hadn't said anything about this. Had the girl actually married the man who had beaten her senseless and put her in the hospital? No. As far as he knew, Wilhelm Hoffritz had been unmarried. Dan hadn't been to Hoffritz's house yet, but he had read over the available background information, which contained no reference to a wife or family. Others had tracked down the next of kin, a sister who was flying in from somewhere, Detroit or Chicago, someplace like that, to handle the funeral arrangements. Marge Gelkenschettel would have told him if Regine and Hoffritz had married. Unless she didn't know about it. According to the DMV files, Regine Savannah Hoffritz was female, with black hair and brown eyes. She was 5'6", 125 pounds. She'd been born on July 3, 1971. That was about the right age for the woman about whom Marge had spoken. The address on her driver's license was in Hollywood, in the hills, and Dan jotted it down in his notebook. Wilhelm Hoffritz had lived in Westwood. If he had been married to Regine Savannah, why would they have kept 2 houses? Divorce. That was a possibility. However, even if it had ended in divorce, the very fact of the marriage was nonetheless bizarre. What kind of life could it have been for her, married to a vicious sadist who had brainwashed her, who could completely control her, and who had once beaten her so severely that she had wound up in the hospital? If Hoffritz had savagely abused Regine when she was a student of his, at a time when he had his entire career to lose by indulging in such perverse urges, then how much worse might he have treated her when she was his wife, when they were alone in the privacy and sanctity of their own home? Thinking about that gave Dan the creeps. Earl Benton had his gun in his hand. But what came into the kitchen from the darkness outside wasn't something that he could blow away with a few well-placed rounds from his .38. With a resounding crash, the door was thrown against the wall, and a cold whirlwind surged into the kitchen, a wind like a living beast, hissing and growling, sniffing and capering. And if the substance of the beast was wind, then its coat was made of flowers. for the air was suddenly filled with flowers, yellow and red and white roses, stalky impatience of every hue, scores of blossoms from the garden behind the house, some with stems attached and some without, some that had been snapped off and some that had been torn out by the roots. The wind beast shook itself, its coat of flowers flapped, and, as if shedding loose hairs, threw off torn leaves, bright petals, crushed stems, clumps of moist earth that had been adhering to the roots. The calendar leaped off the wall and darted halfway around the room on wings of paper before settling to the floor. With a soft rustle not unlike the flutter of feathers, the curtains flew up from the windows and fought to free themselves from the anchoring rods, eager to join this demonic dance of the inanimate. Dirt spattered over Earl, and a rose struck his face. He was aware of a thorn lightly nicking his throat as the flower rebounded from him, and he raised one arm to protect himself. He saw Laura McCaffrey shielding her daughter, and he felt helpless and stupid in the face of this amorphous threat. The door slammed shut as abruptly as it had been forced open, but the churning column of flowers continued to spin, as if this wind was not part of that greater wind which scoured the night outside, but was instead a self-sustaining offspring. That was impossible, of course. Crazy, but real. The whirling turbulence whined, hissed, spat out more leaves and blossoms and broken stems, shook off more dirt and buds and bright petals. In its many-windowed, ragtag coat of rolling vegetation, the wind creature stopped just inside the door, though its breath could be felt in every corner, and remained there, as if watching them, as if deciding what it would do next. And then it simply expired. The wind didn't die slowly. It stopped, all at once. The remaining flowers, which it hadn't yet cast off, dropped to the kitchen tiles in a heap with a soft thump and rustle and whoosh. Then silence. Stillness. In the unmarked police sedan, in the McDonald's parking lot, Dan terminated the link with the DMV computer and accessed the telephone company data banks once more. He got a number and address for Regine Huffritz. It was the same address the DMV had provided. He glanced at his watch, 9:32. He'd been working with the VDT for about 10 minutes. In the bad old days, before the advent of the mobile computer, he would have wasted at least 2 hours gathering this information. He switched off the screen, and a deeper darkness crept into the car. As he finished his second cheeseburger and sipped his cola, he thought about the rapidly changing world in which he lived. A new world, a science fictional society, was growing up around him with disconcerting speed and vigor. It was both exhilarating and frightening to be alive in these times. Mankind had acquired the ability to reach the stars, to take a giant leap off this world and spread out through the universe. But the species had also acquired the ability to destroy itself before the inevitable emigration could begin. New technology, like the computer, freed men and women from all kinds of drudgery, saved them vast amounts of time. And yet, the time saved did not seem to mean additional leisure or greater opportunities for meditation and reflection. Instead, with each new wave of technology, the pace of life increased. There was more to do, more choices to make, more things to experience, and people eagerly seized upon those experiences and filled the hours that had only moments ago become empty. Each year, life seemed to be flitting past with far greater speed than the year before, as if God had cranked up the control knob on the flow of time. But that wasn't right either, because to many people, even the concept of God seemed dated in an age in which the universe was being forced to let go of its mysteries on a daily basis. Science, technology, and change were the only gods now, the new trinity. And while they were not consciously cruel and judgmental, as some of the old gods had been, they were too coldly indifferent to offer any comfort to the sick, the lonely, and the lost. How could a shop like the Sign of the Pentagram flourish in a world of computers, miracle drugs, and spaceships? Who could turn to the occult seeking answers when physicists and biochemists and geneticists were providing more answers day by day than all the Ouija boards and seances and spiritualists since the dawn of history? Why would men of science, like Dylan McCaffrey and Wilhelm Hofritz, associate with a purveyor of batshit and bunkum? Well, clearly they hadn't believed it was all bunkum. Some aspect of the occult, some paranormal phenomena, must have been of interest to McCaffrey and Hofritz, and must have seemed to them to have a bearing or an application in their own research. Somehow, they had wanted to join science and magic. But how? And why? As he finished his Diet Cola, Dan remembered a fragment of rhyme. "We'll plunge into darkness, into the hands of harm, when science and the devil go walking arm in arm." He couldn't recall where he had heard it, but he thought it was part of a song, an old rock and roll number, perhaps, from the days when he had regularly listened to rock. He tried hard to remember, almost had it, thought maybe it was from a protest song about nuclear war and destruction, but he couldn't quite seize the memory. Science and the devil, walking arm in arm. It was a naive image, even simple-minded. The song had probably been nothing but propaganda for the new Luddites who yearned to dismantle civilization and go back to living in tents or caves. Dan had no sympathy for that point of view. He knew that tents were drafty and damp. But for some reason, the image of science and the devil walking arm in arm had a powerful effect on him, and a chill spread through his bones. Suddenly he was no longer in the mood to visit Regine Savannah Hofritz. He'd put in a long day. Time to go home. His forehead hurt where he'd been hit, and a score of bruises throbbed all over his body. His joints felt as if they were on fire. His eyes were burning, watering, itching. He needed a beer or two and 10 hours of sleep. But he still had work to do. Laura looked around in shock and disbelief. Dirt, flowers, leaves, and other debris were scattered across the kitchen table and through the uneaten portions of their dinners. Battered roses littered the floor and the counters. Gnarled, broken bunches of red and purple impatience bristled out of the sink. One white rose hung through the handle of the refrigerator door, and bits of greenery and hundreds of detached petals were stuck to the curtains, the walls, and the doors of the cabinets. On the floor, a mound of limp, ragged greenery and wind-burned blossoms marked the spot where the whirlwind had died. "Let's get out of here," Earl said, the gun still in his hand. "But this mess," Laura began. "Later," he said, going to Melanie, pulling the somnolent child up from her chair. Dazed, Laura said, "But I've got to clean up." "Come on, come on," Earl said impatiently. His ruddy country boy complexion had vanished. He was now pallid and waxy. "Into the living room." She hesitated, surveying the tangled debris. "Come on," Earl said, "before something worse comes through that door." Chapter 23. Regine Savannah Hofritz lived on one of the less expensive streets in the Hollywood Hills. Her house was a prime example of the eclectic, anachronistic, madcap architecture, which was actually rare in California, but which chauvinistic New Yorkers pointed to as an example of typical West Coast tastelessness. Judging by its use of brick and exposed exterior wall beams, Dan supposed that the house was intended to be English Tudor, though there were elaborate carved Victorian eaves, American colonial shutters, and big brass carriage lamps of no discernible period or style flanking the front door in the garage. The two pilasters framing the entrance to the walk were stucco with Mexican tile trim, bearing heavy wrought iron lamps utterly different from, yet no nearer the Tudor ideal than, the brass fixtures employed elsewhere. A black Porsche was parked in the driveway. In the ghostly white radiance of the various and clashing lamps, the curvature and sheen of the car's long hood was reminiscent of a beetle's carapace. Dan rang the doorbell,
withdrew his police ID, waited with his shoulders hunched in the chilly wind, and then rang the bell again. When the door finally opened, it was on a security chain. Half of a lovely face peered out at him. Lustrous black hair, porcelain skin, one large and clear brown eye, half a precisely sculpted nose in which the one visible nostril was as delicately formed as if it had been made from blown glass, and one half of a ripe and alluring mouth. She said, "Yes?" Her voice was soft, breathy. Although it might have been her God-given voice, completely unaffected, it nevertheless sounded phony, calculated. Dan said, "Regine Huffritz?"
"Yes?"
"Lieutenant Haldane, police. I'd like to talk with you. About your husband." She squinted at his identification.
"What husband?"
He heard another quality in her voice, a pliancy, a meekness, a tremulous and yielding weakness. She seemed to be waiting only for a command that would reduce her to unquestioning obedience. He didn't think her tone had anything to do with his being a cop. He suspected that she was always like this, with everyone. Or, rather, she had always been like this since Willie Huffritz had changed her. "Your husband," he said, "Wilhelm Huffritz."
"Oh. Just a minute."
She closed the door, and it stayed closed for 10 seconds, 20, half a minute longer. Dan was just about to ring the bell again when he heard the security chain being disengaged. The door opened. She stepped back, and Dan entered past 3 pieces of luggage that stood to one side. In the living room, he sat in an armchair, and she chose the rust-brown sofa. Her posture and manner were demure, yet her primary effect was powerfully seductive. Although she was a striking woman, something about her was not quite right. Her considerable femininity seemed studied, exaggerated. Her hair was so perfectly coiffed, and her makeup was so exactingly and faultlessly applied, that she looked as if she were about to step before the cameras to film a Revlon commercial. She wore a floor-length, cream-colored silk robe, cinched tightly at the waist, to emphasize her full breasts, flat belly, and flaring hips. The robe was excessively frilly as well, with silk ruffles up the lapels, at the collar and cuffs and hem. At her tender throat she wore a gold mesh dog collar. It was one of those close-fitting necklaces that had been popular years ago. These days, among the general population where such jewelry had no significance beyond mere decoration, dog collars could be seen only occasionally. Though among sadomasochistic couples, such items remained in demand because they were seen as a symbol of sexual subservience. And though Dan had met Regine only a minute ago, he knew that she wore her collar with that submissive and masochistic intent. For a crushed and obedient spirit was evident in the way she averted her face, in the graceful and yet humbled way she moved, as if anticipating and perversely welcoming a blow, a slap, a cruel pinch, and in her avoidance of eye contact. She waited for him to begin. For a moment he said nothing, listened to the house. Her delay in removing the security chain from the door led him to suspect that she wasn't alone. She had hurriedly consulted with someone and had obtained permission before letting Dan in. But the rest of the house was quiet and apparently deserted. Half a dozen photographs were arranged on the coffee table, and all were of Willie Huffritz. Or at least the 3 facing Dan were of Huffritz, and he imagined that the others were, too. It was the same unremarkable face, the same wide-set eyes, the same slightly plump cheeks and piggish nose that Dan had seen in the driver's license photo in the wallet of one of the dead men in Studio City the previous night. He finally said, "I'm sure you know that your husband is dead."
"Willie, you mean?"
"Yes, Willie."
"I know.
I'd like to ask you some questions."
"I'm sure I can't help you," she said softly, meekly, looking at her hands.
"When was the last time you saw Willie?"
"More than a year ago."
"Divorced?"
"Well..."
Separated?
Yes, but not in the way you mean. He wished that she would look at him.
Then in what way do you mean it?
She nervously shifted positions on the sofa.
We were never legally married.
No, but you have his name now. Still considering her hands, she nodded,
Yes. He let me change mine.
You went to court, had your name changed to Huffritz?
When? Why?
2 years ago. Because... You won't understand.
Try me.
Regine didn't answer at once, and as Dan waited for her to form her explanation, he looked around the room. On the mantel above the white brick fireplace was another gallery of photographs of Willie Huffritz, 8 more. Although the house was warm, Dan felt as though he were in a Rocky Mountain January night as he stared at those silver-framed, carefully arranged images of the dead psychologist. Regine said,
I wanted to show Willie that I was his, completely and forever his.
He didn't object to your taking his name? He didn't think you might be setting him up for a palimony case?
No. No, I'd never have done something like that to Willie. He knew I'd never do something like that. Oh, no. Impossible.
If he wanted you to have his name, why didn't he marry you?
He didn't want to be married,
she said, with unmistakable disappointment and regret. Although Regine's face was bowed, Dan saw sadness like a sudden gravitational force pull at her features. Amazed, he said, He didn't want to marry you, but he wanted you to carry his name, to indicate that you belonged to him.
Yes.
Taking his name was like being branded?
Oh, yes,
she said in a hoarse whisper, and upon her face blossomed a smile of genuine pleasure at the memory of this strange act of submission.
Yes, like being branded.
He sounds like a sweetheart, Dan said. But she was unaware of his ironic tone, so he decided to needle her, hoping to break through her whipped dog demeanor. Jesus, he must have been a real egomaniac. Her head jerked up, and she met his eyes at last.
Oh, no, she said, frowning.
She didn't speak with anger or impatience, but with warmth, eager to correct what she saw as his misapprehension of the dead man's character.
Oh, no, not Willie. There was no one like Willie. He was wonderful. There wasn't anything I wouldn't have done for Willie. Not anything. He was so special. You didn't know him, or you wouldn't say a word against him. Not against Willie. You couldn't. Not if you'd known him.
There are those who did know him who don't speak so highly of him. I'm sure you're aware of that. She lowered her gaze to her hands again.
They're all just envious, jealous, lying bastards, she said. But in the same soft, sweet, breathlessly feminine manner, as if she had been forbidden to mar her perfect femininity with a shrill tone of voice or any other display of anger.
He was thrown out of UCLA. She said nothing. Because of what he did to you. Regine still said nothing, continued to avert her eyes, but she shifted uneasily again. Her robe fell open to reveal one perfectly formed calf. A bruise the size of a $0.50 marred the creamy flesh. 2 smaller bruises were visible at the ankle.
I want you to talk about Willie.
I won't.
I'm afraid you must.
She shook her head. What was he doing with Dylan McCaffrey in Studio City?
I'll never say a word against Willie. I don't care what you do to me. Throw me in jail if you want. I don't care. I don't care.
This was said quietly, but with fierce emotion.
Too many bad things have been said about poor Willie by people not good enough to lick his shoes.
Dan said,
Regine, look at me. She raised one hand to her mouth, put a knuckle to her teeth, and gently chewed on it. Regine, look at me, Regine. Nervously sucking, chewing at that knuckle, she raised her head, but she didn't meet his eyes. She stared over his shoulder, past him. Regine, he beat you up. She said nothing. He put you in the hospital.
I loved him,
she said, speaking around the knuckle upon which her attention was becoming increasingly fixated. He used sophisticated brainwashing techniques on you, Regine. He somehow got in your mind, and he changed you, twisted you. And that's not the work of a sweet and wonderful man. Tears sprang from her and streamed down her cheeks, and her face contorted in grief.
I loved him so much.
The sleeve of Regine's robe slid up her arm when she brought her hand to her mouth. Dan saw a small bruise on the meaty part of her forearm, and what appeared to be rope abrasions on her wrist. She had told him that she hadn't seen Willie Hoffritz for a year, but someone had been playing bondage games with her, and recently. Dan studied the ornately framed photographs on the coffee table, the thin smile on the dead psychologist's face. The air suddenly seemed thick, oily, unclean. A desire for fresh air almost propelled him from the chair, almost sent him stumbling toward the door. He stayed where he was. But how could you love a man who hurt you so?
He freed me.
No, he enslaved you.
He freed me to be...
To be what?
What I was meant to be.
And what were you meant to be?
What I am.
And what is that?
Whatever is wanted of me.
Her tears had stopped. A smile flickered at the corners of her mouth as she considered what she had said.
Whatever is wanted of me.
And she shivered, as though the very thought of slavery and degradation sent a current of physical pleasure through her. With growing frustration and anger, he said, "Are you telling me that you were born to be only what Willie Hoffritz wanted you to be? Born to do anything he wanted you to do?"
"Whatever is wanted,"
Regine repeated, looking directly into his eyes now. He wished that she had continued staring into space beyond him, for he saw, or imagined that he saw, grave torment, self-loathing, and desperation of an intensity that made his heart clutch up. He glimpsed a soul in rags, a tattered, wrinkled, frayed, and soiled spirit. Within this woman's ripe, full, exquisitely sensuous body, and within the outwardly visible persona of the submissive child woman, there was another Regine, a better Regine, trapped, buried alive, existing beyond whatever psychological blocks Hoffritz had implanted, but unable to escape, or even to imagine any hope of escape. In that brief moment of contact between them, Dan saw that the real woman, the woman who had existed before Hoffritz had come along, was like a withered straw doll, dried out by all these years of ceaseless abuse, now a juiceless, miserable creature who'd been transformed into kindling by a nightmare of humiliation and torture. She longed for the match that would ignite and, mercifully, extinguish her. Horrified, he couldn't look away. She lowered her eyes first. He was relieved and sick. His lips were dry, his tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth. "Do you know what research Willie was doing after he was booted out of UCLA?"
"No."
"What project were he and Dylan McCaffrey working on?"
"I don't know."
"Did you ever see the Gray Room in Studio City?"
"No."
"Do you know a man named Ernest Andrew Cooper?"
"No."
"Joseph Scaldone?"
"I wish you would go away."
"Ned Rink?"
"No, none of them."
"What did those men do to Melanie McCaffrey? What did they want from her?"
"I don't know."
"Who was funding their project?"
"I don't know."
Dan was sure she was lying. Along with her self-assurance and self-respect and independence, she had also lost the ability to prevaricate with confidence or conviction. Now that he'd seen Regine and knew the amazing, monstrous thing that had been done to her, Dan had no respect for Hufferts as a man, but more than ever, he feared Hufferts's manipulative abilities, his vicious cruelty, and his dark genius. And more than ever, he realized the need to arrive at a timely solution in this case. If Hufferts had transformed Regine this completely, what might he have achieved in his research with Dylan McCaffrey, for which he'd had more time and resources?